podcast this week. What's that sound? That is the sound of inevitability. That is the sound of an interview with Riz Ahmed and Darius Marder, star and director of the wonderful Sound of Metal. Plus, the usual news and nonsense on the movie podcast. It hasn't had time to write this bit because of reasons. So we'll be inserting something amusing just about here. Think, Chris, think. Something amusing.
Ha ha, that certainly was amusing, Chris. Oh, you've really made me laugh there.
Oh, how do I come up with this stuff off the cuff, guys?
Just amazing.
It is amazing. I amaze myself on a daily basis. Hello, Pod. I'm Chris Hewitt, and welcome to the Empire Podcast. This week, I'm joined by just two colleagues of such lethal cunning, but look at them. Look at them. They are resplendent. Walk around them. First up, as ever, it is our geek queen, Helen O'Hara.
Hello.
Hello, Helen O'Hara. How are you?
I am good. I've been having a productive day. I've refilled my fountain pen. You know, I booked in my car for a service. You know, I've done things. Yeah.
Amazing stuff. Well done. Well done, Helen O'Hara. And crawling back to the fold, apologetic, after shunning us last week for, let me just look this up, the Pilot TV pod. I'm not even sure if I'm pronouncing that right. It is, of course, our great big fucking nerd, James Dyer. What do you have to say for yourself, Jimbo, after missing last week's show in favor of Pilot?
I'm sorry. I just, you know, with the British Podcast Awards coming up, I had to back the winning horse. And it is clear that Pilot is going to sweep the board at the awards. It's going to sweep the one entry that it went in for. And I just felt that I had to be there for that.
Either of our shows are nominated, I will be astonished. I put an entry in that involved you saying the C word about 25 times in a single minute. And as I was putting it through, I was like, is this awards worthy?
I like to think so.
Let's see what happens.
Like Helen, though, I've been doing things. In fact, I have done things you people wouldn't believe, because at lunchtime today, instead of having lunch, I decided that I would drive to my local Sainsbury's and see if I could pick up bargain cut price Easter eggs. Because I figured they'd be like a pound each and I could load up the trolley.
Nothing, right?
Nothing.
Empty shelves?
Nothing. Yeah.
What
nothing.
Happened? How? What? What yeah. the fuck?
Easter
there were
Monday.
100,000 of them in
that's
there.
That's your window now. Yeah. Easter Monday is it.
Am I too late? Is that what it was?
Not even that. They were gone by Easter Sunday this year.
Because
this is what I usually do.
Yeah.
I get up on Easter Monday and I'm like Homer in that episode of The Simpsons where he has the dream sequence and he's running through the land of chocolate and everything. And the joke, of course, is that everything is made of chocolate and he goes up to a chocolate shop and it says half price chocolate. He's so excited by that, even though everything is chocolate. That's basically me on Easter Monday. But for some reason this year, it felt like there was a run on Easter eggs, mm-hmm. and I don't know what happened. I barely got out of the shops of Greenwich with my life and about 5 eggs intact. And that's all I was able to get this year, 5 eggs. That's nothing.
That's terrible. That's terrible. I mean, it's really upset me because my whole week was planned around this. And I thought I was being smart. I thought, you know what? I'm going to go out. I'm not going to wait until the weekend. I'm going to go out on Thursday and I'm going to get them early. And they're was nothing. Not even a fucking cream egg. I mean, honestly, it was an absolute
cream
waste.
No, cream eggs are gone. Mini eggs. Gone.
Oh, forget about it. Yeah,
it's
mini
disgusting.
Eggs are,
it's disgusting. But one thing did come up. Yeah. Obviously, I wasn't on the podcast last week. And yet, apparently.
And it was so much better as a result.
I'm sure the tone was raised. But there was a number of people approached me on Twitter to mention that both you and I have the same freakish way of eating Easter eggs. You revealed it on Empire. I revealed it on Pilot. We recorded them simultaneously. There was no, you know, coordination here. But we are both refrigerators and subsequent smashers.
We're both smashers.
Yeah. Egg smashers. Not flag smashers.
No, not flag smashers. Yeah. I'm an egg smasher. I love it. And I have one left. I have a big old crispy M&M's egg. And last night I smashed my orange Smarties egg.
See, both of those are shit eggs. Well, like, why?
They're not shit eggs because the orange Smarties egg, I didn't realize this, Jimbo, is the chocolate is orange. I didn't realize that. I knew that you got two packs of orange Smarties, which are the best Smarties. I mean, that's just unequivocal. I will not accept debate about this. And you also get a huge, big egg that is made of orange chocolate, which, again, is the best chocolate. So it's all good.
No, but no. No.
You would have loved to smash. You would have loved to smash because I did the thing. I raised it high above my workbench.
And you dropped it.
I dropped it down. It smashed. It's the best smash I've ever done in my entire life. I wish I'd been filming this because one half of the egg crumbled, Jimbo.
And the other half perfectly intact.
The other half remained intact.
Yes.
And the one half crumbled and was contained within the shell of the other half.
It's the dream.
I've never done that before.
It's the dream.
What is wrong with you people?
Oh, it's amazing stuff. That said, Orange Schottler is the devil's excrement. Anyone who doesn't have a Cadbury's egg, there's something fucking wrong with them. Like, genuinely.
Hey, there's a middle ground here. Orange chocolate is good, but it's no Cadbury's egg. Like, a Cadbury's egg is where the egg is at. I mean, I you know me, I like my posh chocolate. I'm not like yous. I like my posh chocolate. I will have a Hotel Chocolat extra thick egg. Thanks very much.
Oh,
I know. Oh,
couldn't
honestly,
make me eat it.
Tell you. Oh, no, it's so good. Yeah, they come in different flavors as well. You get the two halves are different flavors.
Yes, but they're all variants of arse flavoring. And
no,
that's not really what I look for in chocolate.
Anyway, my point being, you can like orange chocolate and also Cadbury's. And also other
understand.
Things.
I don't
feel like
Helen.
The phrase there's a middle ground here could be applied to everything that Jimbo says.
There always is.
What is this compromise of which you speak? I don't understand.
You mean I don't have to take an extreme position on everything?
Yes, only a Sith deals in absolutes. That's all I'm saying.
Oh, boy.
Anyway, this is the Empire Film Podcast. Don't like that name, but that's the name that was given to us way back in the day. Who decided that, by the way?
Well, we thought the Empire Broom podcast would be a little bit misleading.
Well, sometimes I do wonder if we're going to get around to brooms eventually. But anyway, let's talk about fucking films, shall we, rather than eggs. Let us get into this week's listener question, because I have to say, folks, and this is entirely my fault and partly Jimbo's fault, I had a hard in, I'm not going to get into it, what it was, but I'm basically running half an hour late. Jimbo has to go. Do you want to tell people where you're going? Can we say you're going to the dentist?
I am going to
the dentist. Too many eggs?
I'm going to the dentist so that they can remove parts of crunchy egg from parts of my teeth I didn't know existed. I think that's what's happening.
Yeah, that sounds about right.
Anywho, you got a hard out. I had a hard in. Therefore, this week's show is going to be a bit shorter than usual.
So just the 2.5 hours then?
Yeah, just a 2.5 hour record. There was much rejoicing in the streets of the nation, and especially in the little squadcast windows here, because I'm about to announce that this week's three-fact structure has been postponed.
Hooray!
Hallelujah!
And unlike previous weeks, I'm not then going to go, well, just tell me your facts anyway, and then we're going to spend 20 minutes talking about it. What I am going to do is going to move straight on to the listener question. So this week's listener question, I've had it bookmarked for a while. It comes from King of the Moles. That's nice. I wonder if this person is an actual, literal King of the Moles. And he or she, but I'm going to guess he, because of the King of the Moles thing, says, we were watching the Harry Potter films with our 9-year-old daughter. Just watched Prisoner of Azkaban, and she wasn't scared of the Dementors. She said they looked like they need a hug. What other what other movie monsters just need a hug? So, you know, in the interest of the pandemic and, you know, everyone needing a hug right now, because I think we all do. We're so close to maybe being out of lockdown, and I think hugs would be nice. But what other monsters need a hug? And also, do you think a hug would work with a Dementor? I don't think you'd even get close enough to get a hug before they suck your soul out.
Yeah, wouldn't they be sucking your soul out while you're trying to hug them? I feel like that's a really fraught tactic.
Yeah, in fairness, I have dated people like that. No, I think I wouldn't hug a Dementor. I really wouldn't. Or a Ringwraith, for that matter. They've got also, Ringwraiths have got pointy bits. Hug one of those, you'd never play the guitar again.
No, this is true.
Thanos needs a hug, I'm saying.
No, he doesn't.
On account of being much maligned.
Oh. No, he isn't.
I'm coming very, very close to banning you from ever saying that word again.
Yes, let's do that.
I'm just using it as your sort of go-to comedy answer.
I'm sorry, it was not a joke. I was 100% serious. The man had his hand cut off, Chris. He brought whales to the Hudson and they cut off his hand. He needs a hug.
This is true, actually. He was hurting. Hurting real bad. Mm. Real bad. And all he needed was a hug.
Mm.
Bet Ebony Maw tried to hug him.
Oh, good Lord. Ebony Maw would... Nobody else should.
Who else? Would you hug Freddy Krueger?
No.
No. The with those hands? Absolutely not. No. Frankenstein's monster is the correct answer. That's like
he'd hug you to death.
No, but he genuinely needs a hug, and he wouldn't necessarily hug you to death. if you got him in the right mood.
But he, you know, wouldn't he accidentally hug you to death? Doesn't he have form in this area?
He might a little bit have done that sometimes to some people, but usually when he was angry and didn't know how to deal with it.
You'd use the Winter Soldier defense, right, and get him off because apparently he wasn't in control of his own actions
it's
or something like that.
It's not that kind of a hug. Jesus.
Oh my God. It's a very, very special hug.
Wow.
My word. That the Frankenstein's monster would really appreciate. I don't think he'd be alive in that certain part of his body anyway.
Electricity can do a lot of wonderful things.
No comment whatsoever. No wish to discuss that further.
So, you wouldn't hug a Kruger?
No, absolutely not.
Would you hug a mummy?
Whose mummy?
The alien queen. Would you hug an alien queen?
Well, she could hug you with four arms, so that'd be a pretty good hug.
Like the Beatles, Eight Arms to Hold You, which was the original title of Help. Did you know that?
No.
And that's this week's three fact structure.
There you go. I mean, it's not really a film fact, though, is it? But
Help was a movie.
Yeah, okay. I don't know that hugging an alien would be a good hug, even with the number of arms, because they're not very huggable creatures. Like, if Baymax is one end of the hug spectrum, I would submit to you that the alien is at the other. So,
incorrect, Helen. They literally start their life hugging you.
I mean,
but not in a comfortable, comforting way. This is the kind of hug we're talking about, right?
John Hurt looks so peaceful. It looks so serene. What they do is they hug your face, really just like lots of hugging bear, just a nice, warm, smooth little hug. And then what they do is they basically then, yes, they force something down your throat and anesthetize you so that you don't feel any pain. And then obviously then a few hours later or minutes, depending on which bullshit film you're watching, that something will erupt from your chest. But in its own way, isn't that also a hug?
No. But well done for mentioning lots of hugging bear, because he actually is a villain who could be helped by a hug. That would be the case. Anywho, here's an answer that is genuinely true. Darth Vader.
Darth Vader.
He needs a hug.
Why? What's he done?
Because he's lost, you know, he lost his missus and he lost his legs.
I mean,
and he lost
killed his
arms.
Missus. Let's not fuck about.
No, he didn't.
He didn't kill his missus.
Well, he didn't.
He did. She died of a broken heart, Helen.
Because of lack of hugs.
There you go.
Padme a little bit more. Where is Padme? I want to hug her. No!
Is she the handle now?
I mean, it's like,
this?
Dude, the last time you saw her, you were force choking her. Let's not, you know, romanticize your relationship with her.
Yeah, look, I'm not saying he's been blameless, but I'm saying that a hug might have helped. That's all.
I mean, the boy hated sand. He had issues, a lot of issues. He probably needed to work them through. Mm. So we're saying sort of a good course of CBT therapy and that's a tautology, a good course of CBT, and then perhaps a hug at the end.
So who would have hugged him? Yeah. Who are you proposing hugging him?
Oh, well, Chewie, clearly Chewie.
Chewie.
I mean, if anyone's giving out hugs, it's Chewie.
Oh my
Yoda would be
God.
A shit hugger. He'd be able to hug/hump your leg. That's all he could really do. His little arms. There's no way you could hug out of him.
Get off my leg, you little shit. Yoda's trying to, like a little dog. Going, yip, yip, yip.
Yeah. Ewoks again, good huggers, I'm saying. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's fair.
Yeah.
Although, as long as they've been fed and you're not going to be in line for dinner.
Yeah, that would be less good.
So you think that there's something in the redemptive power of a hug, that a hug can put a bad guy or a monster, because we're basically talking about bad guys here at the moment, we're not talking about monsters. You couldn't hug, for example, a Kraken, you couldn't hug a Sarlacc, but you're saying that like a Hannibal Lecter, for example, that all he needs is a hug, like a Dr. No, like a Blofeld. All that was missing from their lives was a big old hug.
Wasn't this literally the story with Dr. Evil?
Dr. Evil.
You know, that he really just needed a hug. So, you know, there are monsters that can be defeated that way. But I think you really want to be trying it with the misunderstood, like King Kong. King Kong needs a hug.
But who's going to hug King Kong?
Look,
Godzilla.
I mean...
Clearly.
Godzilla hugs Kong. That's the sequel.
Yeah. It was an unexpected finale, but, you know.
That'd be great. That'd be so good.
Hug it out, guys. Hug it out.
What are the great hugs in movie cinema? In movie cinema?
In movie cinema. I do love the movie cinema.
Don't worry. I'm going to insert something later on and they won't even know. Totally seamless. What are the great hugs in movie cinema history?
Ooh.
Ooh.
That's turning on its head.
Okay, it's obviously Steve and Bucky in Wakanda. That's one. That's my go-to gif for hugging.
Is it? Why do I get the sense that if you had a VHS of that, the lines would be on the screen?
I don't know what you mean. It's a gif. It's a gift of a gif.
It's the gif that keeps on gifing.
Of course it is. What are the great big hugs? Han and Chewie. That's a great hug, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. Great. So good.
Yes. In Jedi. In Jedi when they're reunited in the dungeon.
Don't they hug as well in Empire whenever Han's been tortured and he gets put back into the cell later on? You know, that whole thing, they didn't ask me anything.
Yeah.
Doesn't Chewie hug him then?
Yeah,
Chewie's
he does,
just an inveterate hugger. He loves it.
Oh, he is. Isn't
and
great?
As someone who has had a Chewie hug, live up to the hype.
what was it like? What were his warm, thick, hairy arms like?
I mean, he smelled of wet dog, but other than that, he's quite, you know, he's quite fluffy and you know, enveloping, I would say, is the word I would use to describe it.
I mean, Baymax is the other great hugger in cinema, actually, genuinely. I know I mentioned him before, but, you know, that's his whole programming, is to make people feel better with hugs.
La 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 la. It's wild. There's only been one of those movies so far.
There is a really good TV show. I do recommend it. It's on Disney Plus.
What's it called?
Yes. Big Hero 6.
Really? I did not know that. I really like the hug in Good Will Hunting.
Oh,
it's not
my
your
God.
Fault. It's not your fault. It's not your fault. It's not
Too
your
soon.
Fault. It's not your fault. Mm-hmm. It's not your fault. It's not
so
your fault.
Are you just waiting until we say something and you're going to say?
Yeah, pretty much.
Okay. Yeah, you're right. That's good.
It's not your fault.
Okay.
Damn it.
I mean, I feel like it. Okay.
Buddy the Elf gave good hug, as I recall.
Yes.
To raccoons or, you know, anything. Chewie hugging Leia in the cockpit of the Falcon comes out as a good hug. There's a gif of it here on repeat. It looks like a pretty decent one.
What about... Michael and Fredo, Godfather Part 2.
Fredo. You broke my heart.
I know. Yeah. The kiss of condemnation as well. Oh, my word. And what about Frodo? From Fredo to Frodo. Frodo must be hugging.
Oh, yeah. Frodo and Sam. Yeah, that's a good one.
Are they always hugging? They must be always hugging, right?
Always
they're
hugging.
Little hobbits.
Every day they're hugging.
Yeah.
Lots of hugging.
Lots of hugging hobbits. They've got to be doing that. What about Tony and Peter? I really like that hug. Forget about Steve and Bucky. Tony and Peter on
the battlefield. I refuse to forget about Steve and Bucky.
The battlefield of Avengers Endgame. When, you know, Peter's doing his whole spiel, having Peter Parker, by the way, not Peter Quill. Tony Stark would never hug Peter Quill, not after what he did. But Peter Parker, and there's that moment where Peter's just banging on, you know, Doctor Strange was doing the little swirly thing, and Tony just silently hugs him because he can't believe that his kid is back in his life again.
Oh. It's not your fault. What are we defining as a hug? Is it like a full body hug? Can it be a partial body hug? Like, are we saying that Dylan, does that count as a hug?
No, that's not a hug. They like
they're embracing.
Hands.
There's an embrace there. It's just a, you know, arm embrace, but still.
That's not an embrace. That's arm wrestling.
It's more of a wrestle, yeah. Possibly a wrassle.
Yeah, that's a big old wrassle. What about From Here to Eternity when Deborah Carr and Burt Lancaster are doing a very special hug on the beach?
I wouldn't call that a hug. I feel like that is an embrace.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I would say when there's penetration, it's no longer a hug.
There's no penetration in From Here to Eternity.
John Connor hugging the Terminator at the end of Terminator 2. That's a good hug.
That is a good hug.
You must lower me into this deal.
I love that we've turned this completely into... we've gone from hugging monsters to the redemptive and wonderful transformative power of a hug. A hug can make everything right again. Mm. Boo and Sully at the end of Monsters, Inc.
Oh my God, yes. I think there's a hug at the end of The Notebook when her memory comes back. Spoiler.
oh my
that's
God,
a pretty good
Helen.
One as well. I mean, I'm just saying.
I've never seen The Notebook.
Really?
I'm not going to now.
Oh, yes. Yeah, I'm sure that was the thing that was holding you back. There's tons and tons and tons of hugs, but I think the best hug in movie cinema history has to be, without a shadow of a doubt, and Helen, I think you'll agree with me in this one, Hugh Jackman.
He's a huge hugger.
Hugh H. Jackman, that guy is just, whether it's in X-Men or his true masterpiece, Kate and Leopold, he's just a hug in human form. Wouldn't you agree?
Sure. Yeah.
Yes. All right. Well, that silence means that we have reached the end of the listener question section. Hope we answered some of your question at King of the Molds to your satisfaction. If you want to have your question read out on the Empire podcast and get in touch with me on Twitter, wait for a panicked shout out as I did today, although I had this one banked from a few weeks ago. We will be answering some of the questions you sent in today in subsequent issues. Or you can slide into my DMs. I'm at Chris Hewitt on the old Twitters. And remember, folks, it's not your fault. It's not your fault.
It's definitely it's not your fault.
It is my fault. Hugging the Kraken would be really tough, wouldn't it?
I mean, yeah, the Kraken could hug you. I just feel like it'd be hard to make an impact going the other way.
That's true. Do you want to hear a quick impression?
No.
That's a Kraken! That's Frank Carson as Captain Jack Sparrow. Time now to talk about this week's movie news. What has been happening in the world of movie news, folks?
Well, it's been a very big week for trailers, for a start.
This is huge.
So going in probably reverse chronological order, Those Who Wish Me Dead, the Angelina Jolie versus Forest Fires and Bad Guys movie looks pretty fun to me.
Yeah, it looks great. This is her back in action hero mode. And yeah. I've forgotten how good she is at that sort of stuff and how much I had missed her in a movie like this. So she is some sort of fire marshal who happens upon a young man who is running from some professional killers who are after him and for reasons. And who does she trust? Who can she trust?
Can she trust
John Berthold? Can she trust Nicholas Holt? Can she trust any of the various blokes? I tell you what, Aidan Gillen, no, do not trust him. Aidan Gillen, which means he'll be the one who is trustworthy. But this is written and directed by Taylor Sheridan. It's adapted from a book, and Taylor Sheridan is, of course, the writer of the Sicario movies and the director of Wind River, and is a real talent, I would say. I'm pretty much there for anything he puts his name to.
Yeah, I'm excited about this one. I think it's going to be good. So then there's also a new Cruella trailer, which gave us a little bit more plot and a bit less style and looked fun. It kind of made the case that Emma Thompson is dreadful and Cruella may have a case against her. So that's fun. There was a Ghostbusters Afterlife teaser, which saw Paul Rudd versus tiny little cutesy Stay Puffed Marshmallow Man, who are cute.
Yeah. Now, this got a kicking on Twitter, and I wasn't entirely won over by it either. So he's in a store, and he
is buying ice cream.
Because
on board. Yeah. Paul Rudd plus ice cream. Happy days. Mm-hmm. Yep.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Because we're meant to believe that he's a single man? A man who looks like that? Single? I mean, I don't know anything about that,
Maybe it's like one of those early noughties Jessica Alba movies. Maybe he's really clumsy and therefore can't get a girlfriend. You know, the way
take
that
makes
sense.
Off.
No.
That would help.
Do you think that would make the difference?
I think it would make the difference.
Huh.
Anyway, so then he is in the store and he happens by some Stay Puffed marshmallows, and then the bag starts moving and he looks at the bag and out pops a little Stay Puffed marshmallow man who tries to bite his finger. And then this feels like much more of an edited clip of what we're going to see in the film.
Yeah, it very much is, I think, yeah.
And then there's loads of little Stay Puffed marshmallow men who are running around the store like gremlins and they're trying to cook themselves and toast themselves. And
I was wondering about their end game there, not to name another franchise, but I mean, surely they shouldn't want to s'more themselves. Surely others should be s'moring them. And that's how, you know, maybe we get rid of the little marshmallow men.
Whatever gets you through the night, whatever works for you. If they want to do that, if they want to self-immolate, then that's entirely up to them. That is their right as marshmallow
as tiny men. Marshmallow people.
Tiny marshmallow men.
It did make me want to sit around a campfire and roast marshmallows. I will say that.
It did. And also, the Stay Puffed Marshmallow Man and Gozer in general, that is another monster that needs a great big hug.
Do you think?
Mm-hmm.
I think you, again, struggle to make an impact on there. But, you know, very huggable monster, at least.
I just think the Ghostbusters didn't interrogate the situation enough.
Properly.
They didn't. They went straight to crossing the streams and they didn't consider hugging. That's all I'm saying.
Yeah, Yeah, so you would have hugged the Stay Puft Marshmallow Man or like the demon dogs? Or we, like,
no,
who
you
are
don't
we hugging
hug
in this?
The demon
I guess there's four of them. Like one of them could have hugged Marshmallow, one of them could have hugged each of the dogs.
Precisely.
You know,
right?
In Venkman's defense, he was definitely trying to hug one of the dogs.
Yes, there's no question about it. Venkman is a hugger, but just, you know, he is slightly shonky, problematic hugger. That's all. But the whole point of Ghostbusters 2, the whole thing about Ghostbusters 2 is about overcoming negative energy. And how do you do that? By singing
positive
and dancing.
By stealing
and
the Statue
hugging.
Of Liberty and singing, yes.
Yes.
Yeah, but, okay. You know, okay.
So I'm just saying that maybe they could have hugged Stay Puft Marshmallow Man instead of reducing him to atoms.
Fair enough, yeah.
But what do you think of this? Did this make you positive about Ghostbusters Afterlife or not?
I remain hopeful of that film. I hope that it will be fun. It looks like they're going in a slightly more kid-friendly direction.
Yes.
I think the hardcore fanboys who rejected the last one probably hoped. But, I mean, fine. If they want to make a kids Ghostbusters film, that's not bad. We all grew up on the rail of Ghostbusters, and it hasn't hurt any of us, has it? So yeah, it'll be fine. It'll be good.
All right.
Yeah, there was also the Black Widow latest trailer.
Yes.
My favorite thing in this is none of the images. It's not any of the new snippets of dialogue. We get a tiny bit more from Yelena, Florence Pugh's character. My favorite thing is that they did a sort of Russian choral version of the Avengers theme, which very much amused me and which I'm extremely here for. So, yeah, I remain as excited as I was about that film, to be honest.
Well, we shall save our rendition of that for the spoiler specials, I think.
I know, right? We're just going to have to learn to speak Russian, guys. Get Duolingo on the case. Other language courses are available.
Yes. It does feel a little bit like they've gone with the trailer for this. Hey, you guys like the Avengers. Remember Black Widow? Because this was meant to come out a year ago, and yeah. I do wonder if they feel it may be. It's falling through the cracks a little bit with everybody going nuts about WandaVision, perhaps less so about Falcon and Winter Soldier, getting nuts again about Loki, and then focusing on all the other stuff that's coming out, whether it's Shang-Chi or Eternals or Spider-Man, Doctor Strange, all that stuff. And I wonder if they're going, Black Widow may be falling through the cracks a little bit. Hey, stick the Avengers theme on it and we'll position it as Avengers 8.3. You know, it's like, it's an Avengers movie, folks.
Look, I'm totally here for that, to be perfectly honest. Yeah,
whatever works, whatever it takes.
Whatever it takes.
Indeed.
There was, I haven't mentioned probably the most talked about trailer of the week, which is Space Jam, A New Legacy. Which, I mean, you know, it's a trailer for a Space Jam movie. So LeBron James goes through a mysterious portal and finds... What?
New co-part owner of Liverpool Football Club, LeBron James. So I will not have any criticism of him or Space Jam to A New Legacy on this podcast.
I mean, it's literally our job, Chris. I don't know how we deal with that.
You're absolutely right. You've called me on it. I'm going to remain impartial. Please talk more about the Space Jam 2 A New Legacy trailer.
Sure. So LeBron and his son, who's played by Cedric Joe, are trapped in a digital space by an evil AI who's played by Don Cheadle.
Brilliant.
And
fully
the only way to get home is to lead the Looney Tunes gang to victory.
Loved it.
Wow. In a game of basketball.
Cried that bit. So good. So good.
Right. So, wow, you're really sold on this. And yes, they're up against very overpowered digital champions. And it ends up, for some reason, with like all of the WB characters who ever were appearing to watch the game.
Groundbreaking. Really? Groundbreaking, I mean, in his visionariness.
Droogs from A Clockwork Orange are really in a kids movie now?
You see, you could say that's problematic from one point of view, but I see it as LeBron is pushing the boundaries of cinema and what cinema can do and what he's kind of forgiving the Droogs and going, yes, they were in that movie and they did some bad shit, but now they're in a more kids-friendly, better movie that's going to win all the Oscars because LeBron James is brilliant.
I mean, you certainly have a take, so far be it from me to in any way question that take. Yeah. But this is a film that's happening.
I think we can all agree the most egregious thing about Space Jam: A New Legacy is that if you now go to spacejam.com, you get the Space Jam: A New Legacy website and not the 1996 Space Jam website, which has been there for 25 years.
Oh,
it's like,
no.
like an artifact of the history of the internet, and these fuckers have replaced it with an all singing, all dancing 2021 version.
Did they not put it aside, like genuinely?
Funny you should say this, Helen, but if you go to the all singing, all dancing website, this could be my fact. And then if you...
No, it can't. You've said it now.
If you click the Space Jam logo in the very upper hand right of the screen, it will take you to the original Space Jam's new home, which is spacejam.com/1996. And
that's
they have
amazing.
Archived it for posterity. So it does still exist out there.
Oh, thank God.
I highly recommend you go and look at it.
If you do sometimes think, what did the internet look like in 1996? Can I recommend empireonline.com for you? Really cracky website. Do check it out. But what do we think of the, because, you know, all my love for new Liverpool co-part owner LeBron James aside, a lot of people did look at the trailer and kind of go, hey, the Droogs from Stanley Kubrick's A Clockwork Orange are in this movie. And I know it's just a background joke, and the idea is that all the Warner Brothers IP is in there. So you imagine all sorts of things that are, you know, not exactly kid-friendly.
Sure.
Jimmy Cagney, the end of White Heat. He could be in there, right?
Probably.
So lots of people were a little bit perturbed by the Droogs turning up in what is a kid film.
Yeah, and the repetition of what Ready Player One did with the Iron Giant, who having him as a sort of this destructive force running amok, apparently. Obviously, we haven't seen the film yet, so that may not be entirely fair. But the original was silly and full of basketball, and this looks like
it
will be
Clockwork Orange.
A Clockwork Orange, famously a great basketball movie.
Yeah. A little bit of the old ultra-violence and basketball.
You remember that famous quote?
Yes. White Droogs can't jump.
Anywho.
Yes. So that's a thing.
That's a thing. You say it was the most talked about trailer this week, and I
do you think?
Wonder if you did. You said that.
Yeah, I did.
Wonder if Loki
think?
Might have superseded it.
That's fair. That's fair.
The trailer for the second trailer for Loki came out, and this one I was already fully on board.
Mm-hmm.
And if it's possible to be even more fully on board, the only way I could be even more fully on board Loki after seeing the second trailer, which is really, really funny and plugs you into the plot a little bit more, which is that Loki, the Loki who was in Avengers Endgame, the Loki who has just tried to take over the Earth in the first Avengers movie, now has a Tesseract, and it is immediately pulled over by Owen Wilson's Time Cop and his bunch of Time Cops, who's like, wow, Loki, no, wow. It's not cool to do that, Loki. And so they basically make him try... I wasn't sure about the rest of the plot after that, but they basically try and pull him aside for crimes against time.
Yeah.
If that makes any sense. So I love the visual style of this. It's directed by Kate Herron. It looks different. It feels experimental and fun in a way that WandaVision did. I love the banter between Tom Hiddleston, who looks like he's having a ball in this role, and Owen Wilson. And it just makes you think, how has the Marvel Cinematic Universe survive without Owen Wilson being really deadpan for 23 films and 2 TV series?
It just, I mean, I feel like I had this, what was it, Wonder he was in a couple of years ago, and it felt like I hadn't seen him in anything at that point for years. And he comes back and you're just like, Owen Wilson's great, man. Like, where has he been all our last few years? You know, it just, he's one of those incredibly likable screen presences, and I'm super, super happy to see him in this. So it just looks good all round. It just looks really fun, weird. Mm. I still don't entirely know what's happening in a lot of scenes, which is the way I like it, actually, after a trailer. Yeah, having a super good time. Cannot wait.
I'm still holding out for kind of Loki plays Sam Beckett in Quantum Leap type format.
He is, isn't he?
Yeah. You're right. It looks like this has many layers to it, and it looks like it's going to be something to unpack. It looks like it's going to have all the things that maybe Falcon and Winter Soldier is lacking, you know, like...
So far.
Stakes and direction and...
Hey, look,
all
it's,
those sort
it's
of things.
All going to come together in the last three episodes. All
yes.
of it.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it
yes.
will.
Yes.
Hope.
But yeah, this looks like tremendous fun. I love the bit where Owen's character says, oh, you're a big metaphor guy. It makes you sound smart. And you know, just little things like that. But my favorite gag is the bit where Loki is put into some sort of bureaucratic nightmare where he is a man prints out a huge pile of paper and says, please sign here. This is everything you've ever said in recorded history. And to which Loki replies, this is absurd. And then there's a beautifully timed gag as he prints out another piece of paper with this is absurd written on it. And it goes, sign here.
Mm-hmm.
If it's that clever and that daring and that fun and that Douglas Adamsy, then I'm absolutely here for it.
Yeah. Celestial bureaucracy. What a laugh.
What, I'm genuinely, what, like, not, what not a laugh. Kidding. What a giggle. And listen, whilst we're talking about Loki, it behooves me to say that, as if by magic, the new issue of Empire is on sale next week. And we have revealed today, I believe, the cover of the next issue of Empire is none other than the God of Mischief himself. It is Loki. It is a Loki cover, but it's not just a Loki cover. It is a Tom Hiddleston cover.
What a Loki man.
What a low-key cover that is. And he's back. He's been away from our screens for a couple of years, but he's back in Loki. And we have a big old Tom Hiddleston piece in the next issue that is well worth your time, folks. So just putting you on notice right now that next week is when the issue goes on sale. All good and evil and digital news agents, get yourselves ready. Get your money ready, folks. If you want to buy it online, you can do so by going to greatmagazines.co.uk, and there you can buy your very own Loki cover. How exciting. There you go.
Right.
Plug over. Let's talk about other things.
Well, yeah, it's been a big week at Warner Brothers, even apart from this Space Jam trailer, with a couple of bits of sad news for films that were in development. So Ava DuVernay's New Gods and James Wan's The Trench have both been shelved for the moment over there. New Gods, the news came, so Ava DuVernay has for several weeks now been getting people going on at her, frankly, about casting Ray Porter, who played Darkseid in the Snyder Cut, to play the same character in her movie. She was avoiding the topic, of course. Ray Porter, to his credit, asked the fans to stop harassing her. And of course, it turns out that there was a good reason for her being quiet on the subject, which is that this project has now been shelved, which is a shame. So it could come back. And Warner Brothers have stressed that if it does, you know, these will be the people who are involved again. It's nothing against them, but they're not going with those stories. And they are planning, apparently, to have more of these interconnected films, which will have TV spin-off shows from their films going ahead. So we're going to have a John Cena-led spin-off series called Peacemaker from The Suicide Squad. We're going to have a Gotham Police Department show spinning off from The Batman, because God knows we know nothing about them. So, but these two appear to have fallen by the wayside, which is a shame because they sounded weird and bizarre and very, very different to anything else that we had right now.
Yeah. I kind of thought this was becoming the DCEU's thing, that it wasn't pursuing the joined up franchise thinking of the MCU, that it was very much beginning to plow its own furrow, which was, it wasn't worried about continuity or a collective. It was, hey, filmmaker, do you want to make your weird fucking film that about, you know, evil beasties that live in the ocean? Yes, I do, actually. Thank you very much indeed. Or, you know, the Jack Kirby, mad Jack Kirby creations of the New Gods. Do you want to do that, Ava DuVernay? Yes, I do. And I do wonder if maybe they're beginning to head back in the other direction again. Nothing wrong with that if it results in belting films.
Yeah.
Very, very here for The Suicide Squad and The Batman and Aquaman 2 and all that stuff that's coming up over the next year and a half or so. But yeah, I thought that they would have had the freedom to allow filmmakers to pursue this stuff.
Apparently not. So the Batman will be in an alternate universe, that is Earth 2, but the Earth Flash will be Earth number 2.
Oh, okay. Not to be confused with the TV show Earth 2 from the early 90s featuring Clancy Brown.
Thanks, James. I mean, that doesn't sell it at all to anyone, I don't think.
Really?
I mean, I love Clancy Brown.
Wow.
I love Clancy Brown. He's great, but...
Didn't see him in Earth 2, though, did you?
No, I don't think anyone did, James. Anyway, but yeah, they are, as you've talked about in the past, Chris, setting up The Flash as their sort of multiverse establishing, clarifying film for this new phase.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, hey-ho, so it goes.
Onward and upward.
onward and upward. This week also saw, obviously, a lot of chat about Ray Fisher's revelations about his treatment during Justice League, and the upsetting news that we could have had Regé Jean Page earlier, in that he was up for a major role in Krypton and was turned down. So that was sad.
Krypton, the Superman slash the prequel type thing.
Yeah, the Superman prequel. He was going to play Superman's grandfather. It did, yeah. But you know why nobody watched it?
Because Regé Jean Page wasn't in it.
I mean, Bridgerton worked, you know, so it kind of makes sense.
Blimey. Blimey O'Reilly. Couple of last things before we get into the movie reviews. So it seems as Sly Stallone confirmed this week that he's not going to be in Creed 3. How does that make you feel?
I'm not as invested as you, Chris, so I just want to check, are you okay?
You know what? I'm okay.
Okay. Okay, good.
I'm okay. At a certain point, this franchise has to learn to cope without Rocky Balboa. Mm-hmm. And I also think that he got a really lovely send-off in Creed 2. Mm. Mm-hmm. Like, he could have done it. He could have just become a Jedi ghost and just faded away. You know, it was such a nice little send-off for him. And part of me does wonder how, you know, Adonis Creed is going to cope with that rock in his life, but it's a nice opportunity to plow some new dramatic ground, yeah. I would say, especially for Michael B. Jordan, who's going to be directing as well.
Yeah.
I think, you know, this gives Jordan a chance to try out on his own and gives him a chance to shine. Like, he's really charismatic in that role. Mm. And I'm interested to see what he does without Rocky there to guide him. So, I'm fascinated by what Creed 3 is going to be. I really am. Such good films. It's unexpectedly good films. Like, when Creed was announced, I was a bit meh. I went to see it, thought it'd be a bit meh. And fuck me, but they are really good.
Yeah.
Yeah, really, really, yeah. Really good.
Love those movies. Love those movies. So a third one, yes, I'm totally here for that. Anything else has happened? I see that Amazon has snapped up the rights for the Tomorrow War, which is a big old Chris Pratt-led action sci-fi pick that's going to be out later in the summer. But I have to say, you know, I was really, really heartened this week to find an email in my inbox. Usually I'm not happy about getting emails. It usually means work. But and I guess it means work in this case as well. But we got an email, a lot of us did, from Universal outlining their return to theatrical strategy for the rest of the year. Because it does seem that the success of Godzilla vs. Kong, which opened this week and made around about $300 million at the worldwide box office, including a big old chunk of change in the States, has given studios the confidence to finally embrace the theatrical experience again. And so Universal sent out a big list of release dates for all their movies coming up over the next few months, including things like obviously No Time to Die and Edgar Wright's Last Night in Soho and Kenneth Branagh's Belfast, but also things like Freaky, the long-awaited Freaky, which is going to be out in June. I recorded an interview for that in October, I believe it was,
of last year. In October.
Really?
Yes.
So there's loads of great stuff coming out, and I'm just really, really glad that hopefully we're getting very, very close to being on the other side of this thing.
Because bear in mind that as we record, we are... Well, by the time this goes out, we'll be sort of 3 days away from outdoor cinemas and drive-ins opening, and then just over a month away from actual indoor cinemas opening. So Monday the 17th is the date. Not all of the chains
At
the moment, yes, it is obviously a movable feast. But at the moment, it is the 17th, and not all chains have announced that they are opening on the 17th. But I know Cinehouse, we're now calling them.
Picture World.
Cineworld / Picture House are definitely opening on the 17th. Odeon have films listed for the 21st, so if they don't open on the 17th, they'll definitely be open by the 21st. So it is looking like we will be going back to cinemas, and I am very excited about it. Mm. Obviously, there'll be a few different chains. I think a lot of chains are going cash-free and contactless, and they're encouraging people to book online as well for their safety. Masks and social distancing will be in effect, so people don't need to worry about contracting a deadly virus when they're there to watch a film. But that does mean the closure of the pick and mix super spreader bars as well, so you know.
I mean
Strawberry Cable is part of my movie process, Helen, but sure.
Oh, forgive my process.
My process involves eating strawberry cable. Yes.
Yes. I just do want to mention a couple of more pieces of casting news. First of all, that Salma Hayek has joined the Gucci film, the House of Gucci film that Ridley Scott's making, which has an incredible looking cast. And if you see the paparazzi shots from the set, the fashion, the 70s fashion, is off the charts. She, of course, joins Lady Gaga and Adam Driver as the central pair there. And I also want to mention, for anyone who read young adult literature, as it wasn't then called, in the 80s. The fact that Benny Safdie is joining Are You There, God? It's Me, Margaret, which is really, really exciting for a number of reasons. First of all, it's being directed and adapted by Kelly Freeman Craig, who made Edge of 17, which was bloody brilliant. Mm-hmm. And secondly, it has a really, really strong cast all around. Abby Ryder Fortson from Ant-Man is playing Margaret, with Rachel McAdams as her mum, and then Safdie as her dad, and Kathy Bates as her grandmother. And it's all about a young girl basically trying to figure out her way through adolescence, puberty, crushes, periods, boys, all of it. So it's a really important book for a huge number of generations of women at this point. Judy Blume, mm-hmm, book, bloody fantastic. So this is exciting. This is good news.
Is there a Jack Reacher in it?
I'm going to say yes, Chris, because I think you'll really enjoy it.
I'm fully on board for Are You There, God? It's Me, Reacher, coming to your screens very, very soon.
God said nothing.
Yes, please. God wouldn't stand a chance in that fight, and we both know it. Very, very quickly. James, Helen. Hello. Star Trek Picard, Season 2, John Delancey, Q, go.
Yes.
I was very excited to hear that. Although, obviously, Q is an ageless immortal being and John Delancey is like 70 years old or something at this
reasons.
Point.
There's reasons. There'll be reasons. It'll be fine.
Yes,
he'll just be playing around.
I suspect he
will
make himself look older to make Picard feel better about himself.
Exactly.
But yeah, it's been a long time. Like, Picard's not coming back now till 2022, so I will have been Picardless for like the better part of 2 years. That is brutal.
Dude, you just got through like decades without Picard. Like, you're going to survive.
But he's back
gap.
In my life now, and I don't want to give him up. Flawed as that first season was, I really enjoyed mm-hmm. it. So yeah, I'm pretty psyched to see this. And Q coming back is that's some good shit.
Yeah, I mean, look,
the trial never ends, Helen.
And it has to end where it began. You know, Encounter at Farpoint. There's Q, so we uh-huh. need Q here.
You know how it's going to end, don't you?
Do we
with Picard wrapping his arms around Q and giving him a big old
hug.
That's how that's going to end.
Sure.
Time now for this week's guests. And I'm delighted to say that it is Riz Ahmed, the wonderful British actor Riz Ahmed, and Darius Marder, who are the star and director, respectively, of Sound of Metal, in which Riz plays a heavy metal drummer called Ruben, who very, very quickly and shockingly just loses his hearing and has to struggle with that. This is an incredible film. We'll be talking about it in a few minutes in the reviews section. It is an Oscar contender. If you ask me for Riz in particular, it should be an Oscar winner, but we shall see. We shall see what happens. But I caught up with him a couple of months ago now and chatted to them about the film and everything involved with it. And does that mean I can't remember what we talked about? You're absolutely damn right. But it was a fun interview. Anyway, do please enjoy Riz Ahmed and Darius Marder. Delighted to be joined on the Empire Podcast by the star and the director of Sound of Metal, Riz Ahmed and Darius Marder. How are you both?
Good, hey, thank you.
Nice to meet you, Chris.
Oh, nice to meet you. You know, across the electronic pond, so to speak. Whereabouts are you guys at the moment? Obviously, you're not together.
It's more sad for me than it is for Riz that we're not together.
We were together and decided I had to just get some space. So I'm in.
Well, you
LA.
Don't have to say it like that.
Well, I'm here to speak truth.
Yeah.
He's all the way across the country from me. I'm on the East Coast. And every time I go to LA, and this did literally just happen. I said, I'm coming to LA. You're like, I'm leaving. So it's pretty much, you catch what's happening here, Chris.
I get it. It was a fun working experience, but Riz, you've no desire to actually be in the same room as Darius. So that seems to be fairly clear.
Boundaries.
Indeed. You guys were in Toronto with this movie back in September 2019, if you can remember that far back, because I know that last year alone seemed like 25 years in one. And you shot this in, 2018?
Yeah.
So is this an experience? I mean, obviously, this is one of those experiences where we're now almost two and a half years down the line after you shot the movie. But it seems to me, Darius, you say in the production notes that Riz might describe this as life-changing, this experience of making this movie. So is this a film that has stayed with you both through that hiatus, so to speak?
Certainly has with me. It certainly has with me. Somehow this film changed everything for me, in not in superficial ways. Like the actual making of it seemed to mirror some kind of real seismic shift in my whole life. And it really has... has been a process of tremendous transformation, actually.
Artistically, or?
Well, yeah, artistically. And I think it's interesting. It's an interesting experience to usher something into existence over such a long period of time with such a high level of intensity and intentionality. And in that process, kind of start to understand what's deepest and most exciting and most interesting about this project and why you're so hungry for it and why you want it so much. And then to realize that when you start to ask those questions, you actually have to start to live those questions. And that's what I found with this process, is that it made me have to really identify why is this so strong? What is at play here in this film on a spiritual level, on an emotional and personal level? If I'm going there, I got to go there. You know, when you ask someone like Riz to go through a process like he just went through for this film, you best be willing to go through it yourself. Otherwise, that's not really a trusting experience, you know? So that's what it's been for me. It's been a deep emotional dive for me as well.
And Riz, for yourself, you were agreeing with Darius when he said, yeah, it was life-changing.
Yeah, for sure. In many, many different ways. I mean, just the intensity, I think, as Darius mentioned, and the intentionality, you know, the intention was to make this as real as possible, as authentic as possible. And the intensity of kind of preparing for it every day for 7 months. And then, you know, this very kind of potent and kind of concise shooting window that we had, and then also shooting it chronologically within that window, meant that we were kind of living this story. You know, as Darius said, when you tell a story like this, or you know, any kind of really great story you get to tell, it ends up kind of being reflected in your life. The lesson that character learns, the lesson that you have to learn. And I guess we kind of ended up living pretty much in character, a lot of us for the better part of a year. And not really breaking that, kind of being, not wanting to break that. And so those experiences stay with you.
Mm. Ruben is a really interesting character. Is he a character that has stayed with you in some way? Is it a character that you were sad to say goodbye to?
Yeah, but the beauty of film is that the film lives, you know, so like in a funny way, Ruben lives.
Yeah.
Riz, sorry. Were you sad to say goodbye to Ruben?
Well, yeah, I was going to say in a different way that I don't think you ever do say goodbye to the characters that you play and you meet. Part of them stays with you. As I said, I think that the characters end up teaching you something about yourself. And if that lesson stays with you, then the character stays with you, you know. And I think for me, the lesson that Ruben taught me is the lesson that Ruben himself had to learn, which is about the limits of control, the illusion of control, what is lost when you lose control, but also what is gained when you allow yourself to lose control. That's something that Ruben has to confront, because, you know, he's someone who tries to micromanage his daily life and his daily existence, because if he doesn't have that structure, he will lapse back into addiction. So he has his RV, which is in this cocoon that he lives in with Lou. He has his itinerary mapped out, and this is what we're doing. And it's all kind of structured in a way to prevent him from having to sit alone with himself. It's constantly on the go. It's constantly with someone else. It's constantly externally focused. And when he loses control, that very clever plan and way of life is designed kind of forced to the wayside. And he's forced to do the stuff that he's been running away from. And similarly for me, I think, you know, filming this and stepping into Ruben was a process of doing a lot of preparation, but then surrendering to the process, giving up control. And I think I learned a lot about what's possible when you do give up the desire to control a process.
One of the key motifs, I guess, or one of the key themes of the movie is about Ruben's search for stillness. And obviously we're not going to get into spoilers here. So I'm not going to reveal whether or not Ruben finds that stillness, but going back and rewatching the movie, I thought it was interesting because the opening shot is of Ruben at the drum kit, and it looks almost as if he's in that moment of stillness already there. But you go back and watch the movie again, and he's not. He's agitated, and he's waiting for something to happen, and he just can't wait for that moment to kick in. It's a fascinating character to build. Where did you start? I mean, this is for both of you, but Where did you start in terms of that?
Well, I love that you bring up that the different perception of that opening shot. That's really cool because that's very much there. You know, that is the temple for Reuben in the beginning. You know, that is that place of that is that kind of holy place as being on stage behind that kit, waiting for the cue and that kind of erotic charge that can come from that. That's everything. But then you realize that, you know, as you watch the movie, that monster lurking in the movie really isn't Deafness at all, but is there in that first frame. Mm. And so I think that's a wonderful observation. That this character, you know, I was just talking to my brother about it. I mean, it's so many years in the making. It goes back. The character of Reuben really goes back about 9 years in terms of the actual putting it to paper. But what it took to find that character was such a wonderful creative kind of dive. And it's just super personal, ultimately. It's very personal to both me and my brother. And we really, first of all, we just love Reuben. You know, I still get so upset when people say that Reuben's not likable in any way. I just love that character. Yeah, people do. Just recently, didn't that happen, Riz? Someone said something about they didn't.
I raised that from my memory immediately. The moment that happened, also raised that person from my phone book.
I want their names. I want their names. I want these people's
heads. We'll never
speak
their name.
Reuben's flawed, but he's so. Yeah. But he's someone that, you know, I really feel deeply, and his desire to take care of the world, to take care of everything but himself, and to really take care of everything, even in spite of himself. And that is a character I know in myself. I think it's a character. It's a fascinating thing about Reuben is how many people along this ride that I worked with had Reuben inside of them. So many people that worked on this movie had Reuben inside of them. And I just found that really powerful as we made this film. And certainly, we wrote hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of pages of development to get Reuben and his language and his fascinations and fixations to such an extent that I remember when we were setting up the Airstream and my brother was, we were talking about the gear in the Airstream and that the gear was slightly wrong. My brother was having a complete meltdown. Like, that's not Reuben. If he has that gear, if he has that compressor, that's not Reuben. Reuben wouldn't have that compressor. I mean, we are geeking out on Reuben. And my next movie should be called Geeking Out on Reuben. anyway, Riz, how about you?
It's interesting because I think drums are his kind of his therapy, his catharsis, the place where he can be most expressive and most vulnerable. So if you have that taken away from you, then there is this kind of volcanic eruption inside that doesn't have a place to kind of go. I think that it's interesting because when you've got a brilliant script, which you did with this project, and you've got an amazing director, which is really evident to anyone who sees the film, and every scene is a kind of microcosm of the entire story. And I think that's true of really every scene in this film, but never truer than in that opening sequence, you know, where you kind of you understand that kind of need and desperation he has to connect and to find purpose and to find catharsis in the safe space of performance. Mm. Which is safe because it is a performance. It's not, yeah, it's him, but it's not him.
It's a shield.
Yeah, absolutely. So I don't know. It was interesting. It was just that I think after, you know, doing all that preparation and kind of living in the character for the better part of a year, by the time we got to that gig, and, you know, Olivia's so amazing to work with, we had so many band rehearsals by that time. But when we got on stage, a lot of those dynamics, they just found us, you know. It wasn't a process of, oh, let's try it this way. Now let's try it. We'll tweak it this way or that way. It was like, we're going to start this really intense process and then we're going to surrender to it. And whatever comes out of that is right. And it did feel right.
And it's really interesting as well in the terms of the, I'm going to try and say this word and I always fuck it up, specificity. I did it. There you go. I did it.
I always mess it up also.
I can't believe I said it first time. That's amazing.
always get that word right.
Oh, really? Yeah. I thought you might. Somehow I thought you might. But it's it's such a specific character in terms of, you know, his look, his mannerisms. And Riz, you're coming in, you have the 7 months of preparation, but you have a director here who has had Ruben walking around in his head for the best part of a decade. So how did the two of you work in terms of, you know, the finer details about Ruben, the tattoos, the look, and his approach to life? Did you ever?
It was just a lot of discussion. It was a lot of discussion, and again, it was about welcoming in things that presented themselves during that journey of preparation. And one of the things, one of the people that really presented themselves to us as a kind of spirit guide was Sean Powell, who's a drummer from the band Surfboard. Darius introduced me to him, and a lot of his tattoos are Ruben's tattoos. And Darius and I would talk about what tattoos mean and where they are and why and how they might have got there and what point in his life and so how faded they would be. And, you know, the blonde hair, I guess, was an interesting opportunity for Ruben to try and remold himself. You know, he's someone who's trying to control his environment, control his life, control how the world sees him and who he is. And so if he can customize his body and his hair and his, you know, even though we see him topless and, you know, shirtless at the start of the movie, in a way he's got the most amount of armor on at that time. And so, yeah, I guess Ruben is someone who is trying to construct a particular version of who he is, and then try and cling on to that idea of who he is throughout a lot of the film when we meet him, for sure. And so because Ruben's engaged in that, we were also engaged in that process, if that makes sense. There was like nothing about Ruben's life was by accident in a way.
Yeah.
And so we had to have that kind of detailed discussion around all those choices that the character would have made.
And Darius, did Riz do anything that made you see Ruben through fresh eyes?
Oh, yeah. I mean, one of the things about this process is that it's very meta on a lot of levels. I mean, I this is pretty much where I live as a director, which is to say the energy of my own expansiveness and acceptedness is very much a part of Riz's ability to be accepted and be seen. And so when you give a character to an actor, you're giving that character to that actor. You're not controlling the character through an actor. And when you start to do that, it turns into a shit sandwich. It has to be a mutual trusting process. So that means trusting in your actor's instincts. That means also working internally, you know, on myself and recognizing those instincts to control. And when that can actually extinguish life and extinguish impulse. So as much as it is kind of a real ushering, you know, Riz as much as possible into his own impulses, it's also giving away something and allowing for something bigger. You know, I always say in filmmaking in general, if it's as small as I am, we're in trouble. You know, I want it to be so much bigger than me. And that's what makes this journey so magical, is when it's bigger than me.
But I have to ask you both, actually, at some point in this preparation process, how scared were you both that Riz would be shit at drumming?
I was very convinced I would be shit at drumming. But Darius actually was just so encouraging. Although privately, he may have also been shitting himself.
I actually myself privately, to be honest. I'm working on it, but yeah,
no, it's a thing.
it's interesting because, like,
oh, don't
that journey of playing the drums was just, it was the bane of my life and the obsession of my life for that period of time. And what you start to realize is, with anything, any place you put your attention, you put your energy, it becomes a mirror. And so you realize, you know, the way you do anything is the way you do everything. And the issues you may have with playing the drums, the issues you may have with everything, with your relationships, with your life, with the way you approach your work, your family, your sleep, your exercise, you don't hit it hard enough. If you hold the sticks too tightly, if you're trying to control too much, if you're holding too much tension, if you're always anticipating and getting ahead of it, if you're always slightly behind, if you're losing focus, it's a tremendous mirror, you know?
Yeah.
the drums, but partly I think because it's so primal, so physical, it's so in the body, and it's ancient, you know, it's arguably the most ancient kind of nonverbal communication, you know, that we have. So something about it was like learning an instrument, but also like intense psychotherapy with my drum teacher, Guy Licata, who I refer to as my drum teacher and my therapist in a way.
It really is that process, though. The first time Riz picked up sticks, I was with him and it was with Sean Powell. And man, it's like, this guy thinks, I mean, you're such a kind of a savant in general that, you know, I experienced it as like, you know, the Matrix when Neo downloads like jujitsu or kung fu, you just felt like you could download drumming. Like you held the sticks and you were like, I will be able to do this now. And it just doesn't work that way. And it's actually by virtue of the process that became the building blocks of Ruben. I mean, and that's why I wasn't scared about the drumming, because I was very willing for it to be what it was in service of that process. Because I was more excited about the process than the product.
Yeah. And I've got to let you go, you guys go now, but I just want to ask one last very, very quick question. I suspect this movie's bound for a number of major awards nominations. I don't want to jinx it too much, but I suspect your sound editing, your sound mixing teams will certainly be in the mix as well. Pun unintended. No pun intended whatsoever. But I stumbled into that one. I apologize. The sound in this film is incredible. I know, Darius, you talked about it being, you know, the movie's almost sound in three acts. And it's extraordinary the way you present it. And Riz, the way that you portrayed Ruben's reaction to suddenly being deprived of this thing that gives him so much power, obviously, you know, being a musician. Can you talk very quickly, I guess, about how you managed to do that on set? Did you try as best you can to recreate those conditions for Riz?
I'll just quickly say that one of the many bold things that Darius did in this process, alongside deciding to shoot on film and having this crazy sound design, which he can talk about in the post, and deciding to shoot chronologically, is actually to try and make everything as for real as possible. So you're really going to play the drums, you're really going to do sign language, and you're really going to lose your hearing at certain points. So we took these hearing aids, put them into a white noise setting, buried them deep in my ear canal until I couldn't even hear the sound of my own voice. And he would activate that on set in real time to throw me off balance and to disorient me at different moments. And we decided that those moments when Ruben really doesn't like his deafness, we're going to use those audio blockers, and that noise, that storm in his head is going to be real. And the moments when he realizes deafness is a culture, an opportunity to connect more with himself and others, we're not going to use them. So that was one thing that we used.
Yeah. I mean, in general, everything just had the highest stakes we could possibly devise. That was the methodology of the shoot. And you really had to walk that walk. And all of that is designed to have authentic experience in front of a camera. And it's a very harrowing journey. I found it just remarkably joyful by the time we were shooting. I just enjoyed the hell out of it. But it's a tightrope. And I had many, many, many moments in production when everyone was like, this is nuts. And it was, in a way, it is nuts. But you know, what's more nuts is to try to control something and think it's going to come out as a beautiful experience.
Absolutely. No plan survives contact with the enemy, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, exactly.
well, guys, I've got to let you go, but I have to say it's a tremendous, tremendous film, and I wish you every success with it. And thanks so much for talking to me.
Thanks, Chris.
Thank you.
And that was Riz Ahmed and Darius Marder talking about Sound of Metal. And I think really, even though this week sees release of my favorite film of the year so far, we'll get to that in a second, because there's really only one place to start, and that is with Sound of Metal, which is very nearly my favorite film of the year so far. It's an incredible, incredible film.
Yeah, it's really astonishing. So Riz, as you said, is Ruben, who's a drummer in a punk metal duo with his girlfriend Lou, who's played by Olivia Cook. And they literally travel around the country in an RV together. They're touring with their music. They're planning to record an album. And they've kind of saved each other from, difficult lives. He's a recovering addict. She engages in some self-harm off screen, just for people worried about trigger warnings. It means that when he does start facing this hearing loss, he really faces losing everything. Like, every aspect of his life is connected to the music, is connected to what he does. And so it just gives it even more impact and severity, and just presents an even huger challenge for him. So I just was so desperately invested in him throughout this film. I think Ahmed's performance is, he's never been bad in anything I've seen him in, but it is off the charts good in this, from the first moments of the film onwards. People have been talking about the technical aspects of this film, the sound design, to get across what it is like to lose your hearing this way. That's astonishing. But really, I think it's the, you know, it's the people, it's dealing with this. It's this sort of his kind of panic and the way he's kind of trying to suppress it and deal with it and ignore it as far as possible. It's Lou's, you know, she seems kind of younger. She seems kind of almost fragile at times, but it's her, you know, attempts to get him to find help, to get him to face his problems. And then it's in Joe, who's Paul Racy's character, who is unbelievable. I, you know, he's been kind of kicking around for years, playing sort of smallish supporting roles, I think, in a lot of his work. But this has gotten him a huge amount of attention, and it couldn't be more deserved. So he leads a community of deaf recovering addicts, and Ruben gets some help from them. And he's just an incredible, incredible character. You know, he is tough and demanding at times, and can sometimes seem a little bit almost cultish, but there is such kindness and such compassion in what he does, and such belief that it sort of, it just works, and he feels like an incredibly real character and a real person. So yeah, I mean I was on board from minute one. I barely breathed until the end. I think it's phenomenal.
It is. It kind of, it all revolves around him. He gives this incredibly soulful performance about kind of swimming against the tide and trying very hard to undo the hand that life has dealt him. And I guess it is about acceptance and, you know, learning to just deal with the things that happen to you. But it's, he plays that inner turmoil and that fight against it so well. And I think you're right. Those scenes he has with Joe, who on the one hand is completely accepting of his deafness and the deaf community, and then a guy who not only has to deal with losing his hearing later in life, but the fact that it's not his hearing so much that he's losing, it's his entire existence, which is music. It's his career. It's his passion. It's his love. And to be fair to this, like, I think the use of sound in this film is absolutely incredible. I think the sound designer is called Nicholas Becker, and he does an incredible job of putting you in the head of Ruben's character as he starts to lose his hearing, and then, you know, as how he experiences the world in a different way, and as a man who becomes locked in because he can't sign, he can't read lips, like, he has a fundamental communication problem. It's an incredible performance, and it's really real emotional ride, actually, this film. I found it really affecting.
For a film that starts as abrasively as it does, which is with the performance of this heavy metal, death metal, I don't know how to describe it. And this performance, and it's just absolutely screeching and screaming at you. For it then to be so delicate and fragile and emotional, but not sentimental in any way, shape, or form. Beautifully performed, beautifully directed, and Darius Marder, as you will have no doubt gleaned from the interview, is clearly a director who knows exactly what he's doing. And that is just such a wonderful thing to see. A very, very safe pair of hands to be in indeed, and I can't wait to see what he does next. And Riz Ahmed is one of those performers that, you know, he's really, really talented, multi-talented, obviously.
His performance in The Night Of, which is an HBO miniseries, one of the best miniseries ever, is unbelievable.
He's such great. A good actor. Four Lions and Nightcrawler. But this is, I think, the movie that should put him over the top. And for my money, although I haven't seen The Father yet, and I understand Anthony Hopkins is amazing in that.
He is very good.
For my money, it's the best performance in the best actor category.
Yeah, I think I agree with that. But, I mean, it's a very strong category this year, which has not always been the case recently. But yeah, I don't know. It's really hard because I just watched this last night, so I rewatched it actually. But I'm still kind of in it. But But yeah, I think I might give it to Riz personally right now.
Let's give it to Riz.
Let's just do it. It's up to us, right? We get to decide this. So.
Yeah, this is it. Yeah, they've thrown it. Soderbergh is trying so many new things this year with the Oscars, and he has given it over the acting categories to us to decide. So well done, newly minted Oscar winner Riz Ahmed. Sound of Metal, fantastic film. We gave it 4 stars. I think we're all, sounds to me that we're all in the 5-star camp, actually, though.
I'd edge it up there. Yeah.
Yeah. It's a tremendous, tremendous film, as indeed is Palm Springs, but we're going to get to Palm Springs in a second because I want to finish on a high. And I'm not saying that Chaos Walking isn't finishing on a high, but that's sandwich Sound of Metal and Palm Springs with Doug Liman's new movie, Chaos Walking. Now, chaos has been the operative word with this movie because this movie shot a while ago. And then there were heavy, heavy, heavy reshoots involved as well.
Yeah.
Which might indicate that this is going to be an incoherent mess. Is it so, Jimbo? And I should also point out, I'm going to recuse myself from reviewing this because this movie involves a Hewitt and I cannot comment on any Hewitt.
Well, luckily he's not as big a bell end as you are. He is in fact a good Hewitt, played by Tom Holland. So yeah, this is the adaptation of Patrick Ness's YA series, or rather the first book, I should say, in the trilogy, The Knife of Never Letting Go. It takes place in a dystopian future where humanity has ruined the Earth, go figure, and fucked off to colonize outer space. So in the year, I think it's 2257, we find ourselves...
In the year 2257.
Thank you. They're on this the planet, the imaginatively named New World. Really pushed the boat out
not
there.
Not Earth 2?
No, not Earth 2. Clancy Brown is not in this film. Colonists have been living there for generations, and there are two things you should know about New World. And firstly, there is an indigenous alien species called the Spackle. That is not a joke. And the second is that your thoughts on this planet are amplified outside your head in a phenomenon known as the noise. So everyone can hear what you're thinking at all times. Now, the noise only affects men, but that's kind of purely academic, because in Prentice Town, where we meet Tom Holland's character, Todd Hewitt, no relation, there are no women at all. No women.
What?
That is until Daisy Ridley's Viola, a traveler from sort of like a second wave of colonists. She crash lands just outside Todd's farm and soon draws the interest of the evil town mayor, played by Mads Mikkelsen.
Yes.
But yeah, as you said, this has had a few directors and indeed writers attached over the years, including Charlie Kaufman at one point and Robert Zemeckis to direct. And the reshoots, I think we were in 2019, they spent $15 million, I think, on extensive reshoots. Fede Alvarez stepped in to do it. So there was a lot going on here. It's not had a smooth pass to the screen. All of that kind of does not augur well for this at all. And it's had some brutal reviews in the States. However, this was not the car crash that I thought it would be, and I rather liked it. Yeah, admittedly, it's a YA sci-fi film, so kind of up my alley to begin with. But
you are the YA MC.
I am. It's true.
YA MC.
Oh god. But you know, like I liked it. Like I thought the premise was kind of compelling. I thought, you know, the fact they did it visually, like the thoughts manifest as sounds and images, this kind of miasma of sort of colors and lights and pictures that appear above the men's heads as they think. And there's inherent. Yeah, and there's inherent humor in a boy who's literally never clapped eyes on a girl before having his every thought telegraphed. Our John Nugent described this as what men want with aliens, which I think is fair.
I mean, the aliens don't play any role whatsoever. Like, just to be clear, like, James keeps mentioning them. Just ignore that.
This is where the problem is for me. Like, I thought Holland and Ridley were really, really charming, and I thought the story kind of has momentum to it. The problems, I thought, were kind of twofold. And partly, I think, the story was very lightly savaged, either in the adaptation or in the reshoots, because I don't think it bears as much relation to the book as,
very much not.
I know you've read the book, so you can tell us in a second. But, like, and I think that comes across in the film, because we don't even scratch the surface of either the main story or the mythology of the world. So you're just left feeling like you've had a starter, but you're waiting for the story to kick in when this film finishes. And presumably that would have played out in films 2 and 3, but we're clearly never going to get those. So at this point, you just get the tease of a story without an actual story. And I think the other issue is this is a little bit YA dystopia 101. Like the books are supposed to be amazing, and I really want to read them. This actually really made me want to spend more time in this world and more time with these characters. So I now want to read the books. But I just think a lot of the originality in that probably doesn't really manifest itself on the screen. It ends up feeling a little bit generic, you know, aside from the noise. But like I say, I enjoyed it. I found it compelling enough. I really liked their relationship. And, you know, look, these two guys are both, I think, charismatic enough to narrate a Nat West advert and make it watchable. So, you know, It's good. It's good. It's not the clusterfuck you might expect, is what I'm saying.
Yeah, that's basically how I'd feel about it as well. It is much simplified and sort of flattened from the book, which has a really spiky sense of morality, which gets more developed in the further two books of the trilogy. The books I cannot recommend enough. They are absolutely fucking fantastic. Mm. Incredibly tough reading at times, but really, really great. But yeah, I think they did the noise really well. I think the casting was incredibly likable, but it is basically a, you know, run through the woods to get to X kind of a story. And we do lose a lot from that. So,
as you said, the aliens are completely extraneous to the story.
I wouldn't even have mentioned them in a summary. Like they're completely unimportant.
How's the Hewitt? Good Hewitt?
Oh, of course he's a Tom Holland. So, you know. Yeah, he's my favorite Hewitt for sure.
Definitely. I'm surprised though that they did cast the director of Fright Night to play a Hewitt. He feels they could
Tom
have cast
Holland, it. The historian,
the guy who fixed James's roof.
That's the
guy
one.
Who fixed James, the footballer. You know.
Happy birthday to you. What do we give this?
Well, we Empire gave it two.
Two.
I personally would go three. Yeah.
All right. Give it three. Okay. We're being very rebellious this week. We're giving everything one star more than they got, which is impossible to do with Palm Springs, folks. Spoiler alert, this movie got 5 stars, so we're going to give it six. 6 stars there for Palm Springs. Tell us about this movie, Helen or James, I care not which.
I adore this movie. So Niles, who is not Fraser's brother in this case, he's played by Andy Samberg, is stuck in a time loop. He's at a wedding and he's reliving the same day over and over and over again. But a fellow guest at the wedding, played by Kristen Milioti, who plays Sarah, also gets trapped in the same loop. So it's kind of a Groundhog Day thing, but playing out as this tentative kind of rom-com. But it's also a bit more twisted and clever and weird than that in a way that I find completely and utterly delightful. I genuinely adore this film and plan on rewatching it essentially daily from now to eternity. But, you know, he's...
Well, like the Deborah Carr, Burt Lancaster thing, you're going to watch it rolling in the surf.
Whilst rolling in the sand, for sure. I mean, sand would feel more, you know, on brand for Palm Springs than surf. But yeah, it's just great because, you know, you don't quite know what's going on at first. We join the story kind of halfway through. You know, Niles is already stuck in the time loop and it takes us, the audience, a little bit of a while to realize that. So yes, Sarah then becomes kind of our way in.
They'll now know because we just said that. Forget we said
I've spoiled everything.
Yeah. But yeah, I love this movie. I thought this movie was absolutely terrific. I'm a sucker for time loop movies. I think I'm realizing that now. Yeah.
The Map of Tiny Perfect Things. We've been spoiled for choices.
Yeah, right. Yeah. And I mean, the Supernatural episode, Mystery Spot. You'd love it.
I mean, the best of them all.
Genuinely great. Anyway.
Genuinely great.
But even I laughed at this.
And really?
I was not expecting a lot. And yeah, I thought it was delightful and really funny. I thought they were both fantastic in it. And like I said, it's like Groundhog Day, but with teeth. Like it's got real bite to it.
Yeah.
And there's a real sense of
tragedy
to it. I'm not besmirching Groundhog Day, which is genius. And I really enjoyed The Map of Tiny Perfect Things, even if it is a little bit superficial. But this went to some pretty dark places. J.K. Simmons' character in particular in this has an interesting turn. I loved it. I thought it was great. Would I have gone 5 stars? I don't know. I've maybe been more in the 4 camp, but I do think it's great.
The only danger of giving this film 5 stars is that people go in expecting some kind of treatise on, you know, everything.
Which it
and
isn't.
It kind of is. Well, it kind of is at times.
It
kind of does. But, I you know, sometimes 5 stars raises people's expectations too much. And this is a delicate little film that doesn't have great, you know, pretensions to tell an epic saga across 14 hours. But it's so good at what it does. Andy Samberg is the most likable comedian on earth right now. Okay, maybe John Mulaney. Okay, but look, I'll have them in a like-off if that's what it takes. But I just, Brooklyn Nine-Nine is a work of genius. He is just one of the best guys out there. Popstar was lovely. This is head and shoulders above any of his film work to date. Even Hot Rod Chris.
That's incorrect.
Even Hot Rod.
You know it's incorrect, but I'm going to let it stand because I love this movie so much. And yes, I realize that giving five stars or 6 stars, as we have in this case, can sometimes create unrealistic expectations. So can saying something like this film is going to be your new favorite film and it's going to change the way you think about everything. It's going to revamp your political thoughts, make you so much better at sex than you were before and smell nicer. But all those things are true of Palm Springs, which is a wonderful, wonderful film. It is unconventional. It is unpredictable. It is Groundhog Day's funnier, funkier, fresher, hipper, younger cousin.
Steady.
And I absolutely, I love it. I cannot wait for the hit West End musical that will then open on Broadway and then close very, very soon thereafter in about 10 years' time. It's
hashtag never forget.
Never forget. Groundhog Day the musical, folks. Check it out. It will change your life, make you better politically, make you better at sex, and smell better as well. It's such a great musical. This is a wonderful, wonderful film. I think it's been unfairly overlooked in the Oscar race, I'll be honest with you. I think Christa Milioti should have been in Best Actress consideration because her character has to do loads of heavy lifting in this. It is directed by Max Barbikoff and written by Andy Ciara, who are basically fresh out of film school, and I cannot wait to see pretty much everything they do together after this because it's so far my film of the year. Mm. And in a week containing Sound of Metal, that is pretty damn high praise indeed. Yeah. Anywhere between 5 to infinity stars then for Palm Springs. It is absolutely belting. Belting, folks. Next week, I know that this week we saw a couple of movies hit on Netflix, including Thunder Force, Run, and Concrete Cowboys. We will be discussing those in next week's show because that is it, folks. Because of James's Heart Out, that is it for this week's Empire Podcast. Join us next week for more film-related fun, where we'll be joined by... Holy shit. It's Oney Mahoney from Police Academy. Steve Guttenberg. Steve Ruddy Guttenberg will be on the Empire Podcast. And just maybe, his dog Gracie too. You never know. But anyway, until then... Until we meet again, until that auspicious occasion, it is goodbye from Squadcast name, Lord of the Palm Springs, Helen O'Hara.
Toodaloo.
It is goodbye from Sound of Dyer.
Goodbye.
James Dyer. Oh, yes. It's goodbye from me, Chaos Podding. I'm off to hug the biggest monster of them all. Perhaps it will persuade him to mend his ways. I'm talking, of course, about James Dyer.
You're not allowed.
Yeah, stay away from me. Social distancing.
It's not your fault. It's not your fault.
It is his fault.
It's not. It is his fault. It's totally his fault. Yeah. Thanks for listening. See you next week. Bye. It's not your fault.